Good morning and welcome to the April meeting of the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board. Let's start by thanking the City of Mission Viejo for hosting us and letting us use this nice venue. They've always been gracious hosts, so we appreciate it. I will call this meeting to order. And I'd like to remind all of you that if you would like to speak, there are speaker cards. I think they're in the back of the room there, or you can do it online. We just have two at this time. Our executive officer Dave Gibson's out sick, and our deputy will be attending remote. We have him online. Chris, you? Okay. So I guess the first thing we should do is call the roll and see if we have a quorum. Can you do that, Chris? She should be remote, is she?
Here.
So, I will declare that we have a quorum and make the following statement. Board member Megan Blair has requested to participate remotely at this meeting. Remote participation requires that a quorum of the board be physically present, which it is. And she must remain at a single teleconference location that is open, visible, and audible to the public. Ms. Blair may proceed by participating remotely in this meeting. You do not need to disclose your precise location, but you must disclose whether there are any individuals 18 years or older present in the room, as well as the general nature of your relationship with those individuals. Board Member Blair, do you have any individuals over 18 present with you? She's not online yet? Okay.
I believe Ms. Blair just joined.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Megan, were you able to hear my little request there about whether you have anybody with you?
I was not, but no, my location is 3412 Gage Place, San Diego, California, 92106. I have no other persons with me.
Okay, it's okay to have little ones, just not over 18. So if your kids are there, that's all right too. Ms. Blair, you are required to remain on camera for the entire open portion of this public meeting unless there's a poor internet connection or it would be technologically impracticable for you to do that. If you need to turn off your camera during the meeting, let us know and we'll take care of that. We took care of calling the roll. So with that, I'm going to open for our public forum where individuals that wish to speak on some item that is not on our agenda for today may speak for 3 minutes. And again, I would request that you fill out a visitor or a speaker's card. Please be aware of the time limits. I'll be waving at you if you get too long. Okay.
Can I request that you put your microphone on?
Yeah, I can't hear you, Chris. No. If I heard you right, we need to get the cards from the back table. Is that? I'll go get them. Well, while they put Chris up, we'll go ahead and I will call the first speaker that I have a card for. And that would be Leslie Honda. Honda? Not here, or are you remote? Okay, we'll wait for that to get hooked up. She's the lead ornithologist with San Diego Bird Alliance.
Leslie should be able to talk now. Go ahead, Leslie.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Honorable members of the Regional Water Quality Board, my name is Leslie Honda, lead ornithologist from the State San Diego Bird Alliance. Groups that work hard to protect the wildlife and habitat here in the San Diego region were very disappointed to receive a notification that the city of San Diego will resume spraying chemicals on the La Jolla Bluffs in the sensitive Motlohau State Marine Reserve after 2 years of not spraying. We strongly urge the Regional Water Quality Control Board to reverse this decision, as the city of San Diego should not be spraying any chemicals in the sensitive ecological area due to heavy use by breeding seabirds, marine mammals, and the marine biodiversity. California Administrative Code that states no person shall disturb, injure, damage any bird, mammal, fish, mollusk, crustacean, or other marine life. This area protects the federally endangered white abalone and black abalone and host of native fishes with restricted geographies such as the Garibaldi and critically endangered giant sea bass, seabirds, and marine mammals that belong to this ecosystem. As there's potential for runoff and transference of chemicals from wildlife into the water, no spraying should occur in this area. Not only is the spraying La Jolla Bluffs likely ineffective, as the treatment area covers a small area compared to the areas used by the marine mammals on the bluff areas and the beaches. The city of San Diego has exercised poor management practices spraying a day before it rained in September 2022 and did not present a mitigation plan for larger accidental spills into the waterways. If the Regional Water Quality Control Board is no longer involved, who will provide oversight if the city of San Diego does not adhere to their proposed management practices? We're concerned about the impacts on breeding seabirds, Brandt's cormorant, and western gull that are birds of conservation concern per U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as conservation priorities in 2024. Per the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and California Department Fish and Game Code 3503, chemicals should not be sprayed anywhere near young flightless birds or porous eggshells or in areas where adult breeding birds and marine mammals congregate. Chicks and eggs are especially vulnerable to chemical exposure by transference of chemicals from feet and feathers of the adults when sitting in the nests. Younger birds are flightless up to 8 weeks and are unable to rinse the chemicals off in the water at this time. Ingestion of chemicals by birds from preening feathers or in marine mammals from fur, as pups may ingest chemicals on the mothers when nursing, is also a concern, as young have lower thresholds from body size compared to humans, and detrimental effects may also exist for less than healthy wildlife. As 2024 was another record-breaking year of warm marine temperatures and oceanic conditions are unpredictable from climate change, marine animals face significant changes to survive. Wildlife illnesses are rampant, with current concerns of domoic acid poisoning in marine wildlife and avian flu in seabirds. Why take this risk exposing wildlife to chemicals when wildlife is already facing other challenges for species survival? The Coastal Act identifies the ecologically sensitive Motlahail State Marine Reserve as a marine protected area per section 632T14. We strongly urge the Regional Water Quality Control Board to reverse this decision, as the City of San Diego should not be spraying any chemicals in this sensitive ecological area. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. I'm going to follow that with Brian Elliott with the City of San Diego, I believe. The online.
Good morning. And Chair, you want me to speak on, is this non-agenda, or wanted to speak on the executive officer's report, item number 3. Similar topic to the La Jolla Bluff spraying.
Okay, so we'll, if I understand you correctly, we'll call you back when we get to item 3.
Item 3 of the executive officer's report. Yes, please.
Right. Okay, we will.
I can speak now. It's up to you, Chair.
Excuse me, Chair. We had determined that the people speaking on La Jolla Bluffs would speak during the public forum.
Okay. I can speak now.
Yeah, Chair. It would be best if they speak now. And for a correction of the record, item 3 is specific to the IBWC transboundary flow. So it would be item 2, just for correction of the record. Right. But now would be the better time to keep all the information in one location during public.
Well, I would appreciate that, Mr. Elliott. If you go ahead and go now, then we'll ask you back later if there's a need.
Oh, perfect. Thank you so much. Okay. Chair Sean, members of the board, my name is Brian Elliott. I'm the Deputy Chief of Staff and Policy Director for San Diego Council President Joe LaCava. The Council President's district includes La Jolla and the coastal areas on which this project, a product, has previously been applied. The past decade, it has proven to be a safe and effective method to reduce odor on the La Jolla cliffs. Our local residents and business owners have appreciated the city's use of the odor control counteractant, and the instances of applying the spray have been well known in the area. Following each application, the spraying has stopped the smell, stopped complaints from businesses, and spraying never drew wildlife concerns. Council President LaCava appreciates staff's engagement with the City of San Diego, our vendor, and our biologists in evaluating our application, the best management practices and monitoring, and making this determination. Thank you, and happy to stay on the line if there are questions for the Council President's office. And I know city staff are on the line as well. Thank you.
Right. Well, thank you for that comment. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and call the next speaker, Mr. Beenan, if you're online. And no Mr. Beenan then.
Hello, I'm Carol Archibald from the Sierra Club Seal Society, talking about reasons to stop the spraying on the La Jolla Bluffs north of the coast. Spraying, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay. Spraying the La Jolla Bluffs is likely ineffective as the treatment area is small compared to the larger areas the sea lions haul out in Point La Jolla. The city of San Diego identifies marine mammal excrement as a source of the smell, despite how small the area of treatment is. It is highly likely the spraying treatment is not making any difference. The city haphazardly sprayed chemicals in 2022 and 2023 without identifying environmental conditions that factor into the smell, including temperature, wind condition, tidal cycle, rain, water temperatures, water circulation, and sewage leaks. This lack of acknowledgement of these environmental factors indicate that the city is spraying chemicals not based on scientifically measurable parameters. The 2020 safety data sheet on the spray product, which is called BioCAC, shows safety procedures for humans, not sea lions and birds. These are eye, skin, inhalation, and ingestion contacts, which can be very serious. Hazardous decomposition products of BioCAC are oxides of carbon, carbon monoxide, CO2, which can contribute to climate change. The 2014 SDS also had keep out of waterways and storm sewers, as well as toxic. Transference of chemicals from feet, feathers on birds, and fur of sea lions from a treated area is a concern for the water in the Motlohatchee State Marine Reserve located below the bluffs. Since marine mammals swim and dive underwater and brown cormorants are plunge divers, it is likely they are tracking chemicals into the water, and intertidal animals may be vulnerable to chemical exposure. No studies on how this may affect the sensitive marine ecosystem have been addressed. Spraying seems a frivolous waste since the city is currently in financial debt. Financial resources are required to purchase product and supplies, hire contractors, a biologist, and staff to manage the spraying. The Marine Mammal Protection Act defines level A harassment as any act which injures.
Next.
Did we lose Ms. Archibald?
Ms. Archibald has exceeded her time.
Okay. Well, I'm concerned because one of the other speakers also exceeded their time. But all right. Yeah.
Can you explain to her what I don't? I think that's not the appropriate way to end public comment. Can you explain to Ms. Archibald that there was a misunderstanding about time being ceded to her and that she can finish her comments?
Yeah, I agree. Let's, Ms. Archibald, if you're still on, I'm going to give you another minute to close up, if you would.
Chair, this is Kelly Dorsey, Assistant Executive Officer online. It's pretty hard to hear online what Ms. Blank is saying. So I would imagine that Ms. Archibald did not hear Ms. Blank say that time was up over the sound of the timer.
Right, I agree with that.
I'll try and let people know when time's up since Ms. Blank's microphone seems to be quiet. So go ahead, Ms. Archibald.
Yeah, we have a microphone issue with Ms. Blank. So Ms. Archibald, if you hear us, please go ahead. I'm going to give you another minute or so to finish your remarks.
Ms. Archibald, you'll have to unmute yourself. I've given you the okay to do that.
Thank you, Kelly. We need your help.
No problem at all. I have given Ms. Archibald. Okay. Oh, there we go.
Okay,
perfect.
You
thank
go.
You.
Okay.
Sorry about
so
that.
We'll start again. Spraying the La Jolla Bluffs is likely ineffective as the treatment area is small compared to the larger areas the sea lions haul out in Point La Jolla. The city of San Diego identifies marine mammal excrement as a source of the smell, despite how small the area of treatment is. It is highly likely the spraying treatment is not making any difference. The city haphazardly sprayed chemicals in 2022 and 2023 without identifying environmental conditions that factor into the smell, including temperature, wind condition, tidal cycle, rain, water, temperatures, water circulation, and sewage leaks. This lack of acknowledgement of these environmental factors indicates that the city is spraying chemicals not based on scientifically measurable parameters.
Excuse me, Ms. Archibald.
The 2020 safety data sheet on the spray product, BioCAC, shows safety procedures for humans, not sea lions and birds. These are eye, skin.
Ms. Archibald, I believe that the chair gave you an additional minute, and I think that time is up.
Yeah,
we heard
most of your speak. It just at the end, we got cut off there. So I was going to give you a minute to make a closing remark, and then we'll move on. Okay. Obviously, this is a contentious issue. I believe our staff has looked at it thoroughly, and there are some limits to how much influence we can exert here. I can assure all parties that if the situation were to change, new information, I encourage you to bring it to staff, and we can consider at that point whether there's an ability for us to get more involved. But at this point, I think I appreciate everybody's comments, and I can move on to our last speaker, who is Mr. Beenan. He's online.
Yes, Mike Beenan with the Laguna Blue Belt Coalition. Please
good
review
morning, Mr.
the
Beenan.
Submitted.
Glad to have you back.
Yes, thank you. Please review the submitted comments and videos. We are requesting the board to rescind the previous approval for recreational breaching that releases 2.5 million gallons of urban runoff to Laguna's marine protected areas and popular family beach. Videos submitted show a woman and dog being swept to sea and juvenile whales at the mouth of Aliso Creek to potentially violate the 1972 Marine Mammal Protection Act. Berm breaching and rushing urban runoff cuts off safe public access and strands visitors from returning to their parked cars. Routine water quality tests show fecal indicator bacteria exceeds safe standards 34% of the time. California has lost 90% of coastal wetland lagoons serving as critical nurseries for southern steelhead trout. Without any meaningful regulations, we will face more ocean pollution. So once again, please rescind the previous approval for recreational breaching and protect Laguna Beach from inland urban runoff. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Beenan. At this point, I'm going to move into our board business. Item number one, we're going to consider adoption of the minutes from our March meeting. Do we have any comments or motion to approve?
I'll move approval.
Second.
Chris, would you call the roll?
Ms. Blair?
Aye.
Ms. Cantu?
Aye.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
Ms. Tu?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
Chair Strawn?
Aye.
Motion carries.
And moving to item number two on the agenda, this is time for our chair's report, and is Ms. Morgan here? Nicole, or is she online? I thought she was going to be a person today. Maybe.
She is attending in person. I believe her flight doesn't get in for another 20 minutes or so.
Sure. We'll try and fit her in a little bit later then. Do any of our board members have updates or comments? No? Well, I'll add one. I want to congratulate Celeste on her new grandson.
Thank you. Granddaughter, yeah.
Granddaughter, that's right. I'm sorry.
It's thrilling. We have to have a lot of clean water available for this next generation, yes. So we got to keep working.
Betty, you wanted to?
I just wanted to say that it was kind of interesting that Tijuana River made it into the Indian Times. I just saw an article that was published in it. And I think I sent it along to Dave, so.
It was a good summary. It was interesting. Thank you. With that, then we will move to the executive officer's report. We have that in writing. I don't know how much we want to repeat here. Or
at this point, Chair, we would just take any questions from the board that they would have on anything that was provided in the executive officer's report. We have staff available for that.
Betty?
Yes, I'd like to ask a question on, let me get the titles right here. So we have all of our spills that we see every time we meet. I wanted to know what's a procedure that we follow in terms of seeing when, if we're going to give a fine and when we're going to give a fine and the average amount of time it takes from the time that we see the spill recorded in a report like this to the time we hear about what actions are being taken over the...
OK. Okay, I can respond to that if... Go ahead, Kelly.
No, go ahead, Lori.
Okay. Many factors go into that with regards to when a sewage spill occurs. We have a process where staff gets the information, reviews the reports, and then it goes to our compliance oversight group and gets vetted through that process. And the factors reviewed and a determination made whether or not we move it forward to an administrative civil liability.
And that amount of time is normally, is it a year or 6 months?
Maybe either Kelly or Jeremy. Jeremy might have a better idea when the average is. Or Kel, go ahead.
Yeah, I can jump in. Kelly Dorsey again. There are a lot of factors. If there's settlement negotiations going on, that can take some time. If we're looking for supplemental environmental projects, that can also take some time to find one that meets all of the requirements that we have for those types of projects. I don't know if Kiara is on or not. She would have probably know the average time. I don't see her on today.
We do have Melissa and Ryan.
It can take some time. It depends on which direction we go, Board Member Olson. If we decide to go straight to a fine, it may take less time, but then we may not get the supplemental environmental projects that benefit our region. Or if there's a settlement, that's usually where those projects get plugged in, and that negotiation can take some time. So I'm not sure if there's an average time.
Okay, all right. Let me phrase it slightly differently. So then when Dave brought this up before, he said supplementary projects sometimes were difficult to achieve. And so could we get brought up to date on that or in a little, maybe in his next executive officer statement or in a short presentation to the board that will tell us? I know it depends on whether or not any water reaches a stream. If it's all collected, it falls under a different type of category. But, I see 600,000 gallons, and I just would like to understand how we proceed with that. It's a procedural question.
Okay, so let me reiterate to make sure we have your question and your request straight. So I heard some information about on the average time that staff take to bring the administrative civil penalty to the board, and then some information on successes with our supplemental environmental projects, which ones were successful, which ones maybe weren't, and the time it takes for those. Is that correct?
Yes. Along with, maybe it's not possible for an agency to do a supplemental plan. And so I'd like to know, are we seeing that? That doesn't seem to be an issue. And if we decide on a supplemental plan, then the time from how long does it take for agreement to occur?
Okay. Thank you. Ben.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Can you also add on that report or information back the volume? What triggers the administrative action? Is there a minimum volume to trigger that?
Sure, we can add that as well.
Those are all good questions, and I appreciate it. I think I want to add to that. I've been real involved over the years in trying to get more supplemental environmental projects added, and I understand it's a very complicated process, and the same thing with the quantity and what triggers it. We've been through the process, but I'm not sure about triggers to the process. And another item, and it's just a side comment, I don't mean this to be derogatory at all, but I read something in the paper. I do read it electronically. I'm not totally old-fashioned, but about a healthy fine that we put on the city of San Diego, and it wasn't clear to me if that was one that was just, they were just late in reporting it, or it was something that was basically agreed to mutually by staff, and so it didn't have to come to the board. But I would concern that the first that the board sees or hears about that is in the news. So I think we want to understand that process, and when there is an agreement that's by staff, that we be at least alerted to that or have some background information before we read it in the public. Is that? I hear a comment. Go ahead.
Jennifer Fordyce, attorney for the board. Just wanted to respond quickly on that. So pursuant to the resolution that delegates authority to the executive officer, certain types of settlements have been authorized to the executive officer. Sometimes there's consultation with the chair. It requires consultation with the chair. And so when those settlement agreements are presented by the parties, which are usually a regional prosecution team and a discharger, a proposed settlement agreement is proposed to the executive officer, and then usually the executive officer will talk about it, you know, with the chair. So it just want to make clear, it's staff enter into the agreement, but it's not finalized until it's authorized by the board under delegated authority or by the board in person. So it's not staff entering into settlement agreements.
No, I understand. I understand that the process, and I'm totally in support of it, and I'm not asking to try and, you know, change that in any way. It's just it's. Because of the what brought it up was that the time frame involved in these things can be very long, and it may very well be that I've had a discussion all about that and just either didn't recollect it or didn't, you know, because of time frame, didn't relate to it. So what I'm saying is when things come up in the press like that, if we have an idea that it's going to make it to that level, we need to come up with some kind of a little information blast that just lets us know, you know, because we could be faced with questions and you know, I don't have any problem with the process. I think it's working well, and I was very much in favor of that delegation. I think the process works good. It's just because of the time frame, we can be surprised.
I'd like to give you some context for that. When big spills happen, and then staff reviews them, and if they do move to the administrative civil liability down that process, a complaint can get issued, and then discussions may start for settlement. So some of the lag in this case might be that you've read something in the paper after the complaint was issued, but the matter is still being discussed at the staff level, and the information will be brought to you as board members as our process moves forward with briefings and ACL issuance. So I think we might be in that zone right now where you read something in the paper before maybe you heard more information from us as your staff.
Yeah, I have no doubt that that's probably exactly what happened. I'm just we're talking about the time frame that this all takes it's probably something I need to do a better job of, and that's trying to communicate and stay up to speed on that. And I know we've had some people out sick lately and whatever, so that may be part of it.
Mr. Chair
Strawn, this is Kelly Dorsey. If I can just say something real quick. On the particular item I believe that you're discussing, that was a public notice on the settlement. For settlements, we do have to put them out for public comment. And that item is scheduled to come before the board in June of this year. And I believe that was in the notice that is on the website. It is not something as a prosecution team we can discuss with board members at this point, because we're still in that process. But we did recently post a settlement for public notice, and that will, like I said, is scheduled to come at the June meeting.
So it's, I should have been reading the public notices. Okay, thank you.
It's pending. Yes,
all right.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Go ahead, please.
Since we've brought up how long it takes to start from the process of a spill to the final decision, I think all parties would agree it takes way too long. And the Water Board is the first to agree that it takes way too long. And if we were funded at the levels we were designed to be funded at, we might be able to do it much more expeditiously. So it's usually just as simple an issue that we don't have the staff available to do the very meticulous work that's necessary to get to a fair resolution at the end. And I just feel compelled that I have to say that.
Very good comment. Thank you. With that, unless there's any
Mr. Strawn, I'm sorry. Our state liaison has arrived.
Yes, there you are. Okay, well, let's step back then. Nicole, would you want to go ahead and give us your update now, and then we'll move to our transboundary flow issues.
Okay, I think I got that. Good morning, Chair Strawn and members of the board. It is a pleasure to join you this morning. So just quickly here, just want to highlight a couple items you guys may have talked about. I apologize, I missed the first half hour of the meeting. So hope to see you all at the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting on May 1st and May 2nd. It is the one time a year that we all can get together. excuse me. As board members throughout the state from the regions and the state water board. And so that is a great meeting just for everyone to be in person, get to know each other better, spend a little time, and there's some great highlights and updates from throughout the water board and then also Cal EPA and the governor's office. Sorry, my throat seems to be a little bit dry from my flight this morning. The other item that I would like to highlight is the apologize, looks like this one here actually did not make it onto my report that I emailed to you. We are in the process of updating our had pause real quick here and grab some water.
Well, she's getting something to drink. I'll make had a comment about the WQCC. I have had a chance to look at the agenda. I think it's going to be an interesting meeting. So those of us that can make it in person, if you're online, it's going to start at 10 o'clock. You're going to start the start time a little bit later to allow people to get there, and it will finish by 1 o'clock on the second day. So if you make it.
Yeah, it'd be great to see as many of you in person as possible. The other item, so the State Water Board is in the process of updating the clean water and the drinking water, the intended use plans that go with our state revolving fund. So annually we do update, let's back up here, the policies that go with the intended use plans. So annually we update the intended use plans, and those follow the policies. They follow the scoring criteria and the guidelines that are set out within the policies. So annually, we update the intended use plan, which says this is how much money that we have. Here is how that money is going to be distributed. Now, the policies do not get updated annually. Those are only updated every few years. And so this is one of the years that we are updating that policy. So that is something, in addition to the tenant use plans, to pay attention to. A public notice did go out saying that that we are going to be doing that. We did work with stakeholders and have a staff-level stakeholder meeting. They take some comments in. Staff worked with stakeholders to incorporate those comments into the draft. That draft is going to be coming out for review, and then it will be coming to the board for its consideration. So it's coming out, I believe, at the end of this month for review. So please stay tuned and follow that. I'll make sure that I'll get you the exact dates on when that's coming out. So did want to highlight that item there also. I am available if there are any questions. Okay, see you then.
Thank you. And I understand you're going to join us for our tour this afternoon.
I am. I am looking forward to it. Thank you for the invitation.
That we move to item number 3, which is the special executive officer's report on transboundary flows. I think we've all seen that. Do we have the board have any questions, and does staff have anything you want to add?
I believe Riley Nolan has an update.
Yes. Good morning, everyone. I'll be filling in for Dave Gibson today on item number 3. Which is the sanding update on transboundary flows from Mexico. Just to reiterate, my name is Riley Nolan. I'm a water resource control engineer with the Restoration and Protection Planning Unit. So I have a spoken update today. I don't have a presentation to go along with it, but I'll give my update. And if board members have questions, I'm happy to entertain them after my update. So flows in the Tijuana River currently stand at approximately 39 million gallons per day, which represents a steady decrease as we come off of heavy precipitation over the past month. Now, although we're seeing a decrease in the flow in the river, authorities in Mexico have not yet turned on pump station PBCLA, which diverts dry weather river flows to a shoreline discharge point 5 miles south of the international border in Mexico. As I understand it, the Mexican section of IBWC, CELA, is waiting on repairs to equipment to carry out sediment removal at the river diversion structure. And once those repairs are in place and they have the equipment, you know, they'll carry out sediment removal and turn on pump station PBCLA. IBWC also reports that phase one of the international collector rehabilitation is ongoing. And that's despite several disruptions to the project that occurred in March when authorities in Mexico discovered two previously unknown pipelines that fed into the international collector. And planning is also underway for phase two of the international collector rehabilitation. That will obviously begin as soon as phase one is complete. During phase two, the South Bay International Wastewater Treatment Plant will go 3 to 5 days with no influent. But USIBWC and the operator of the plant, Veolia, are planning for up to 8 days with no influent in case of delays in phase two construction. USIBWC, Veolia, and authorities in Mexico are coordinating very, very closely. I'm even meeting daily to ensure that the plant remains in compliance with its NPDES permit as it resumes operations after this period of no influent. And they've agreed to a plan to resume influent at increments of 5 million gallons per day to ensure that it remains in compliance. And I'd also like to emphasize that there's been a great deal of coordination on both sides of the border to ensure that the rehabilitation of the international collector during this project, flows are being bypassed. They're not being discharged to the river. And that was a pretty substantial degree of coordination between IBWC and authorities in Mexico. So I just want to emphasize that, you know, there's been some reporting in the region to the contrary. So just want to emphasize it's not being discharged to the river. It's being pumped in Mexico to the coast. Now, USIBWC reports that there have been no structural problems with the levees in the Tijuana River Valley or with the South Bay International Wastewater Treatment Plant. And that's despite the heavy rain that we saw in the region over the past month. There have been some issues in Tijuana, most notably the collapse of a 36-inch collector called Sanchez Taboada, which occurred in mid-March, and that did result in temporary transboundary flows to the Tijuana River. The State Public Utilities Commission in Tijuana, CESP, is repairing the collector and expects those repairs to be completed by the end of April this month. And in the meantime, USIBWC actually lent a pump to authorities in Mexico to divert the flows from that ruptured, that collapsed pipeline and pump them into an intact segment of Tijuana's wastewater collection system, which of course prevents that wastewater from entering the river. It's nice to see that coordination. USIBWC has also reported to us that they've completed sediment removal at Goat Canyon and Smuggler's Gulch. The canyon collectors. These canyon collectors capture dry weather transboundary flows and pump them, which are then pumped to the South Bay International Wastewater Treatment Plant. However, excessive sediment loading from Mexico requires a significant degree of maintenance on IBWC's part to ensure that those canyon collectors can function properly. So we're happy to hear that they carried out sediment removal there. I'm happy to report that on March 13th, the United States Environmental Protection Agency formally accepted the Lower Tijuana River Indicator Bacteria and Trash Advanced Restoration Plan, or ARP. You may recall that the board adopted a resolution in December of 2022 approving the ARP and directing the executive officer to enter into a memorandum of understanding with IBWC and EPA to facilitate implementation of projects in the June 2023 Record of Decision between US IPWC and US EPA. And those projects, if fully implemented, are expected to result in a significant degree of control over dry weather transboundary flows. And through accepting the ARP, EPA has acknowledged that this project fulfills California's obligation under the Clean Water Act's Section 303D program to develop a plan to restore water quality in the lower Tijuana River. I'm also happy to report that the Tijuana River Trash Boom, which was a pilot project deployed in December of 2024, has held up during the wet season thus far. It's located immediately downstream of the international border in the Tijuana River Flood Control Channel. And the nonprofits AlterTerra and Rural Community Assistance Corporation, or RCAC, oversee the project and received $4.7 million in funding from the State Water Resources Control Board to design and build this trash boom. Happy to report that it's held up during the wet season. This required some minor repairs, but this project is really meant to study the most effective mechanisms for trash capture and disposal, and to inform a more permanent solution under in accordance with Project J in that June 2023 Record of Decision. Also happy to report that on March 17th, US IPWC submitted the Tijuana River Valley Monitoring Program Work Plan to the San Diego Water Board. This monitoring program is a requirement of US IPWC's NPDES permit, and it's designed to characterize transboundary flows and their pollutants. San Diego Water Board staff have reviewed the monitoring program work plan and have deemed it complete, and US IPWC is expected and scheduled to begin monitoring in accordance with this work plan this month in April. And finally, the Tijuana River Valley Recovery Team Steering Committee met on March 19th. The committee meets quarterly, and in this last meeting discussed potential projects that are could be eligible for funding pursuant to Proposition 4, which was passed by voters in November of 2024. Along with a request that the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, or OEHA, review the findings of the October 2024 Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and Joint County of San Diego Community Assessment for Public Health Emergency Response, or CASPER survey. Let's see, I think that concludes my updates. So if any board members have questions, I'd be happy to take those at this time.
Any questions? Go ahead, Betty.
Yes, I would like to ask, what was OEHA's conclusion and what further studies did they think were necessary after reviewing the CASPER report?
Yeah, so it was just communicated that we would like that to be reviewed. I don't know that their review has been initiated or concluded at this stage, but we can certainly follow up with you when we have more information from OEHA.
I would appreciate it. And then the work plan that we have and the monitoring starting in April 2025, when will the board hear the first report on that information?
That's a good question. I don't know if Melissa Corona, I believe Melissa's on the call, she may be able to speak to that.
Yes, I'm here. So the monitoring will kick off this month. It'll start with sediment sampling at the canyon collectors and in the main channel, and there'll be data collected subsequent to that, and we'll be getting quarterly reports. So the soonest we could get back to the board is in about 3-4 months.
All right. So August, that's about the right time. Okay. Then I had one other question, and that's about the sediment loading and its impact on the wastewater treatment plant. Or were they able to divert all the sediment coming down there?
Melissa? Yes, it's currently not, it's not affecting the wastewater treatment plant at all. Where we've seen some really big impacts is at Hollister Street Pump Station. We've seen some failures occur there in the past due to the excessive sediment loading at the Smuggler's Gulch Canyon Collector, but currently everything is cleared out from the canyon collectors at Smuggler's Gulch and Goat Canyon, so the pump stations are in good shape as well as the plant.
All right, so the sediment problem has been removed, and the pump, was it damaged, or was it able to handle the sediment, or what was the impact?
Yeah, so it was actually a pressure relief valve, and it took a while to replace that, so there was an ongoing spill last year for about 3 months, and then this year for about a month, but now everything has been fixed at the pump station. Everything is operating well, and the sediment has been taken care of. But, you know, upstream in Mexico, there's a very large construction site where there's no sediment and erosion control. So it's not to say that we're not going to see problems in the future, but USIBWC is doing everything they can on their end, north of the border, to try to remove that sediment so it doesn't damage the pump station in the future.
Right, and the flows coming in from Mexico into the Tijuana River Valley. Do we have an update on that? There were quite large flows.
Those,
I wondered if they'd been decreased. Or...
Those flows currently stand at around 39 million gallons per day. I just checked the IBWC
gauge. I'm sorry,
can you
repeat that? And, you know, you don't, unfortunately for my ears, maybe I'm just deaf, but you don't... When you speak through the microphone for the system, it's not quite clear to me. So if you can just go slower.
Yeah, I'll speak up a little bit too. So flows in the Tijuana River currently stand at about 39 million gallons per day. And those are, of course, comprised by natural runoff in the watershed that we're seeing from recent precipitation, as well as likely, discharges of wastewater in Tijuana from their collection system. And during these periods of wet weather, IBWC isn't really able to quantify what percent necessarily comes from, is comprised of wastewater versus natural runoff, but they'll have a better picture of that composition once we enter a prolonged period of dry weather.
So the reason why I ask these questions is because I have heard that as it's warming up, people in Imperial Beach are experiencing odors again. And the air quality control boards have their monitoring in place. And do we get updates from them, or how do we actually get that information to see if it's significant?
They do send out emails daily with concentrations of hydrogen sulfide that are measured at monitoring stations, and indeed they are high. Once CELA, the Mexican section of IBWC, can get equipment into the Tijuana River to remove sediment to turn the pump station back on, PVCELA, the amount of flow that we're seeing in the main channel could be handled by those pumps. Now it's still not treated; it's just sent to a shoreline discharge point at Punta Bandera, about 5 miles south of the border. So it still goes into the ocean. Untreated, but it won't come into the river valley, and so once that sediment can be removed and the pumps can be turned back on, we should not be seeing flows in the main channel if they remain at this level. The pump station can handle the magnitude of flow that we're seeing right now.
So, do you have a date for that?
Nope.
Okay.
I talked to USIBWC yesterday, and I was trying to get a date. But it just, there's a front loader that needs to be repaired. USIBWC lends equipment to the Mexican section of IBWC to remove that sediment out of the main channel. And right now, that equipment is in need of repair. So they're working on it as hastily as they can. They're putting a lot of attention on it and trying to expedite it to have this equipment repaired. They can lend it to the Mexican section, get that sediment out, and turn that pump station back on.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Had one add on. Have they, the trash collector, have they pulled that up or cleaned it out, or do we have that, the trash? I know it's been working pretty well. I'm interested in, they have that. And then does that get analyzed for what it is and where it comes from and what kind of pollution is caught up in there?
Yes. Yeah. So the Tijuana River Trash Boom, the nonprofits that lead that project have awarded a subcontract to an agency, a business called Pacific Rigging. And they carry out the trash removal from the trash boom. And another consulting firm, Dudek, also carry out trash characterization. They have to wait until conditions are sufficient to go into the river channel and remove the trash. Obviously, that requires kind of some of the muddy conditions to dry up. And I do know that during one of the breaks, at least one of the breaks in the rain, trash removal was carried out, and along with trash characterization. And we don't have we have preliminary results of that trash characterization at this stage, but not the formal written report.
So they have made one cleanup, but the rest will wait until there's drier flows, lower flows.
At least one. I meet with them monthly, so it's possible that they could have cleaned it out again since it's dried up a little bit, but I can't say that definitively.
Okay, well, thank you both for that report. It's really helpful and thorough, and we appreciate it. With that, if there's no more questions, we're going to move into our...
Chair Strawn?
Yes?
We do need to ask if there are any public comments on this item, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Do we have any public comments or questions on that, Chris?
No.
Okay. If someone online would like to comment, please raise your hand. I don't see any hands raised. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. It's 10 o'clock. We're going to move into our two information items, which will take a little more than an hour each. Should we take a 5-minute break right now? Let's take 5 minutes, and then we'll come back. And with that, Orange County's presentation on spill response will be next. So get ready. Gather together here. Our 5 minutes is up.
Well, since we're going to have two presentations from this part of the South Orange County, I just wanted to say I'm so pleased we're going to hear two great presentations today that show innovation, both, and also how hard South Orange County is working toward water resiliency and always expanding the portfolio of water. Thank you.
Yeah, I see our board member had to go around to use the other restroom. So, but I go ahead. Since this is an information item, if you're ready to go ahead and start your presentation.
Gary, I'm going to give a short brief introduction while Amanda approaches the podium. So I wanted to welcome everybody to the San Juan watershed. This is our northernmost watershed in the San Diego region, and I think one of the largest. It's maybe a little smaller than the San Diego Bay one. I'm not sure exactly, but it's a large one. Supports two very big rivers, Aliso Creek and the San Juan are the two large, very large water bodies that drain to the Pacific Ocean in this watershed. And Amanda Carr, the Deputy Director of the Orange County Public Works, is here to talk to us about how Orange County and the cities within this watershed implement their illicit discharge detection and elimination system program, which is a component of the regional MS4 permit requirements. Overall, in this region, we have 39 co-permittees that implement these types of programs throughout the region. And these IDDE programs are really one of the ways that the board uses its existing authorities to regulate discharges into a municipal separate storm sewer system to protect the beneficial uses. So with that, Amanda, I'm going to toss it to you.
Thank you very much, Chair Strawn, members of the board. I'm excited to be able to share with you, and it's very timely based on your earlier conversations about sewage spills and responses by the board. I'm going to take you to the moment it happens and when it's reported and what we do. So a portion, Well, I'll be talking about a portion of our IDDE program, which is actually emergency spill response. So it's a very long title because we wanted to kind of give you the path of where do we start. So, there we go. Just to give you a frame of reference of why do we have a spill response program and how did we develop it? So as Lori mentioned, we have IDDE requirements within our MS4 program to respond to illicit discharges and illegal connections. We are also all required, each municipality is required to have a water quality ordinance that lays out the requirements for addressing when spills occur and also how we can then have the legal authority to enforce on those spills. So back in 2002, I think through, you probably are aware through previous presentations that I've made, the Orange County Stormwater Program is a collective program. The county and the Orange County Flood Control District are, the county is the lead permittee. We have a cost share program where we, through with all of our cities, collectively we develop the common programs that all cities follow. We are in two regional boards. We have two separate MS4 permits that generally point us in the same direction. And back early in sort of the MS4 history, they were very, very similar. You know, we were on the same renewal cycles, et cetera, et cetera. As permit renewal has happened, boards have taken slightly different tracts. So our programs have separated a little bit. I now have a North County team that focuses solely on responding and guiding the Santa Ana region permit. And I have a South County team led by Grant Sharp, who I know you're all familiar with, who heads up our South County program and works collectively with our South County cities. However, we have multiple common programs across both both regions, one of which being our PubEd program. I know I gave a presentation on our PubEd, our public education program, I believe last year or the year before. Our spill response program is similar, where this is a countywide program. Actually, instead of 34, we have 31 cities who are part of this joint agreement to handle spill response in a common manner. Three North County cities, larger North County cities, Newport Beach, Huntington Beach, and Anaheim have their own program, primarily because they have a fire department and their own hazmat. So they have the capabilities to handle spill response in-house. The other 31 cities, including the 11 South County cities, we are all part of a common agreement that at the city's direction, so the city has to make the decision, they can, on an incident-by-incident basis, designate the county as the authorized inspector for that incident. We have a 24-hour live spill response line. We also have an online reporting system. So generally, after hours, on the weekends, the county covers spill response for all 31 cities. If calls come in during business hours, the first response is to forward those to the cities. They locally put eyes on the situation, generally deal with what's going on, unless it's a larger event, which I'll talk about in a little bit. They handle that in-house, but once it goes after hours or weekends, it comes into our line, and we have folks on call 24 hours a day to respond to pollution incident response or pollution incident reports. So that just gives you a little bit of the structure, but really what I'd like to kind of talk to you about is how do we train our folks and how do we respond to our instances? But then also to start with, what does the world of spill response look like? Over the last 5 years, we generally get right about 200 calls a year. Breaks down roughly into this. You know, this is a reasonably common, this is what 2024 looked like. So as you can see in the big blue bar, hydrocarbons, that's an easy pollutant to see. People know when they see a sheen on water that, hey, something's gone on here. So this is what we get the most reports on. We'll get reports, like I said, through our 24-hour spill line, through our online complaint report. We also get the Cal OES emergency responses. So if people don't know to call us, but they know to report to the state then points those back to us. So generally, these will be car accidents. You know, if you have a car accident and there's automotive fluid that gets onto the roadway and gets into a storm drain, we get called. If there's a boating incident out in one of the harbors, we get called. You can also see in the green bars, and if you combine sort of the wastewater and the pathogen coliforms, those actually, those two categories end up being larger than our hydrocarbon responses. So as you were talking earlier in your meeting, sanitary sewer overflows are a big portion of what is reported to us. During those instances, we work hand in hand with our sanitary agencies. I'll expand on that in a little bit. And then also discharge exceptions. So these are a lot of, this is potable waterline flushing. This is waterline breaks. There's also a lot of just potable and water exceptions. Also that, just one difference between North County and South County. South County irrigation runoff is prohibited. North County irrigation runoff is still a discharge exception. So there's a little bit of that difference there too, where some of that in North County is going to be in a discharge exception. But we do report in the another of the sort of the teal category there, irrigation runoff. We do respond to those calls as well, and we get those reported to us. So that just gives you a little flavor. Miscellaneous can be interesting things. We get called out, especially in the springtime, when the trees all come out in bloom and all of a sudden there's a huge pollen discharge, perhaps over a channel, and someone looks out and just sees this scene of bright little green dots and they think, oh my goodness, something has happened. We get out there and it's like, no, remember this happened last summer and this is those trees just up the way. We'll also get reports on algae. A lot of times algae will turn color and then people will assume that because the water has changed color that there's been a discharge. We get people complaining about the water that comes out of their tap. We get generally other things that we run to ground and whether or not it needs to be responded to or sent to the to a different location for address, that kind of falls into the miscellaneous category. So I'm very proud.
Can I ask you a question before you move on? On nutrients, I'm surprised nutrients is as de minimis as it is.
I would say that is a big testament to a lot of the work that we have been doing through our NPDES program. And generally, that's kind of hard to know that it's coming from nutrients. But yes, you know, that would be something that we backtrack out of. And that sometimes that's one of those instances where we continually see an algae signal, and then we're able to trace it back up. But yes, in general, we are not seeing, and I could probably go back and look over time how that has changed.
Yeah, but I suspect this is a huge improvement, so congratulations. Yeah.
I know particularly in North County, in the Newport Bay watershed, previously we had a lot of large nurseries. And then as Irvine and that area have developed and those nurseries have transformed over into neighborhoods, you know, we see a lot less of those discharges.
I'm going to follow with a question, too, on that one. I think probably after the drought and the water restrictions and people stopped growing their grass, that we've seen a drop of it in some of the other places we monitor. I was going to ask about the hydrocarbons. Do you get a lot of false reports? I mean, I lead a volunteer water monitoring team down on the San Diego River, and for years we were reporting that there was oil sheen, and then we had a wonderful lady that was a professional geologist, I guess, and she reported that sheen we were seeing, because she could go down and take samples of it, iron oxide or something, and it gets on the surface and you get the sheen. And we realize that for the most part, all of our reports of oil spills weren't. It was a natural bacteria that grows in. Do you get a lot of false reports? Or
we do get
these?
a lot of mystery reports. You know, and also you know, the initial report, they generally tell us what they're seeing and what they think it is, and then is it that when we go out and investigate, it does turn out to be something completely different, or you know, it's dissipated. But we do, particularly for oil response and in the ocean, you know, we do see a lot of natural seeps. Mm-hmm. In general, what's coming into our spill lines are incidences at gas stations or industrial discharges, as well as car, automobile impacts.
And these numbers are the initial reports, not necessarily just the confirmed ones, right?
Because these are after from 2024, and so we generally do then go and confirm, and so this is tracking what we eventually determined the sources
confirmed
to be.
Or at least worth investigating. Okay, thank you.
Sure. So how do we train our pollution responders? How do you learn to respond to emergency instances? We begin with the inspection process. So first we begin with safety, hazardous materials response, as well as the FEMA NIMS, or National Incident Management System, because a lot of times while these can be small onesie, twosie discharges, these also can be very large. You know, we've responded to the American Trader tanker incident. We have responded to very large spills that became federally directed incidences. And we want to make sure that we know how to manage from the small to the large and how to work within the system. And so the NIMS system really gives a very clear chain of command, a clear reporting structure, and we want to make sure that we are able to operate regularly within that process. So we run all of our responses based on that structure. But the actual investigations, they begin with inspection knowledge. So out of our NPDES inspection requirements, we begin training our folks. Our responders start as inspectors conducting inspections at our industrial and commercial facilities. Once they become proficient there, they move up into, we take the Cal EPA Basic Inspector Academy. We make sure that people have at least 40 hours doing environmental compliance inspections. And then they move into sort of trainee mode, where they're helping us respond to the calls that come in during the day. And they leave what they're doing in their regular job. These are additional duties over and above, and they go on the daily calls with our experienced inspectors. Once they have gone out on 10 or more pollution incidences, then we also move them into, we want them to go through the entire process of both responding to the incident as well as working it through the enforcement process. So we also train people through developing the notices of noncompliance and the escalation of enforcement once we have a responsible party and we're going through an enforcement process. So those are sort of all the building blocks that we put people through, as well as the hands-on, basically just going out and being there, because there is no better training than actually working through a situation. Because while general spill response kind of follows a similar pattern, everyone is unique. Every situation you're dealing with is, you're going to be dealing with something new, invariably at night, invariably on the weekend, and sometimes during the rain. But we also, one more. There we go. In addition to sort of the physical response, as you were mentioning, there's the after action. There is the pursuit of enforcement and the eventual legal resolution of the case. We also work very closely with the OC District Attorney in our environmental crimes environmental crimes strike force meetings. We hold regular pollution response meetings, both in-house and with our cities. And we also have an NPDES inspection subcommittee that borders on spill response. So we're sharing all of this information with our cities as we go as well. And then we take it to the next level, where, again, we participate in state-level trainings with the California State Institute Hazardous Material Investigations training. That's a one-week-long focus training where you go through a mock investigation with a team of investigators that are pulled, investigator trainees that are pulled from a variety of state agencies. And then similarly, we also do the advanced environmental crimes training, which similarly is a two-week intensive training where you're working through a mock investigation. My wastewater agency partners, as we mentioned, who are two of which are here in the room with us, but also, as we discussed, sanitary sewer overflows are a major category of our spill response that we do get called out on. With the new state WDRs for sanitary system overflows, we have there are requirements now for collaboration between the sanitary system and the stormwater system. However, Orange County has been doing this since 2010. In 2010, we formalized what we called our CASC program, which was our countywide area spill control program, where we had baseline communications and protocols with how we share information with our sanitary partners. And we're already sharing maps of our systems and having common response programs. So that was something that we started back in 2010. And now with the adoption, it's a statewide requirement. So we're really gratified to see that that has moved forward. This is also part of our WQIP, which lays out how we collaborate with our wastewater agencies on the containment of and recovery of SSOs. And we're also in the process of developing, now changing CASC over into a SERP, a spill response emergency plan, so we check all of the boxes of the new state requirements. This is how we share information. We've moved beyond just sharing maps. We have an open data portal that we share with all of our partners, which has maps of both the flood control system as well as the city's storm drain systems. This is the basis of how we begin our investigations. When we identify where the spill has occurred, this helps us then track where it may have come from, as well as where is it going, and how do we address that. So, as I mentioned, here are the primary ways that people can get to us. When you go to My OCE Services, does this have a point? It does. The far left button is complaints and service requests. And you come down here, down towards the bottom, if you click on the button here, water pollution, or if you just put into the search bar water pollution, you can either get this information page that tells you how to submit the information, or if you click on the button, it takes you there. And that's how we get most of our information. It is starting to transition. It used to fully be on our 24-hour spill line. It now, we're getting a lot of folks who would prefer to go in online. You can report anonymously, or you can put your information in if you want to get updates on what was the response to the information that you provided. So that's a lot of the background and structure. What I like to do is just kind of walk you through some of these pictures of the types of things that we roll out on. Like I mentioned, irrigation runoff in South Orange County, that is a discharge prohibition. So these are the types of instances that we go out. We also get called on automotive detailing. Those, as you can imagine, because they're pretty transient, timing is key. But a lot of times we'll find that it's the same. Well, if we're getting multiple calls, it's one particular business that is probably not doing things correctly. And by the time we get to them, we're able to address that issue. This was an interesting situation. We had a company that was putting in a new industrial fire suppression system. They were using some very old pipe that had a lot of rust inside the pipe. And when they flushed that system, this is what came out to the into the storm drain system and into the channel. So as you can see, this was a pretty visible major input. Actually, it was interesting. The property owner, when he realized that this was happening, he sent his team out to the channel along with our spill response contractor, and they worked to clean up this area as well. So this was, I think, one of those unintended consequences when they didn't realize the impact that this activity was going to have. And then once they did, both, you know, they fessed up to it very quick. You know, this was not something that they were trying to hide, and they also participated in the response.
So I just had a question. So this is a fire suppression system that was flushed. So it's not required to be discharged to the sewer. It's allowed to be discharged to the street or a storm drain.
I'm going to turn. Yes, so it is supposed to go into.
Is it? Does it go?
Yeah, so this was a this is not a regular activity. So this was an on-site decision that we need to clean these pipes out, you know, as and did it without knowledge of the proper way to discharge fire suppression or hydrostatic testing water. So It was a lack of knowledge and understanding.
And Amanda, so it's not an authorized discharge. This is not authorized to go and be discharged into the MS4 system without proper BMPs. And it sounds like from what Amanda is saying that they realized that real quickly, and especially because this is so visible. If the water was clear, but still maybe had dissolved pollutants in it, I don't think we'd be, you know, earmarking this one as a something to look at, but this sort of discharge, it could go to the sewer, but they would need permission to go to the sewer, and that would cost money too. So usually this gets addressed under this sort of program, the IDDE program, and gets controlled with BMPs, but not in this case.
Yes, not in this case. Fats, oils, and grease, when restaurants or strip malls are not maintaining their facilities correctly and we get a clog in that system, it then results in generally a sewer overflow because there's a blockage in the system. This is an area where we do a lot of coordination with our healthcare agency because they will be called out on these, and they also conduct our restaurant facility inspections. This restaurants generally hop on pretty quickly once the incident becomes clear, because healthcare will shut their water off to make sure that the spill, to stop the spill from continuing, they'll shut the water off to the building. If the water is shut off to the building, the restaurant can't operate. So that tends to spark action quite quickly. But, and as you can tell from these pictures, this will happen at night. This is when we get called, is because it happens after hours and out we come.
Sorry, quick question. Mm-hmm. Your colleague mentioned that in the instance with the fire suppression flushing that they paid for the cleanup. They realized they were in the wrong. But is there any sort of, if you will, bill that goes out for your time?
Yes. And, yeah. Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. So just real quickly, that's what the agreement that we have with the cities. This is a service that the county is providing to our the cities that are in the agreement with us. So what we do is our time is billed, when they authorize us to act on their behalf, they get charged our hourly rate. We have spill response contractors to actually do the physical cleanup who we direct on contract. And all of those costs then get billed first to the city, but then through our investigations of identifying the responsible party and going through the enforcement action,
okay, that was my question.
Then generally recoup those. The city then recoups those costs from the responsible parties.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So it's basically pay as you go.
Yes. Yes. However, while I would love to say that we have 100% success rate in identifying where it's coming from and that there is a responsible party, that is not always the case. So either if we were responding for a city, the city will cover those costs, or if it's something that is impacting the flood control district, then that becomes a cost that the flood district covers. With encampments, we've had increasing levels of biohazard waste that we clean up from the storm drain system as well as the flood control system. These are generally reported to us either by residences or a lot of times by our maintenance and monitoring staff who are out in the facilities. When we see these sorts of impacts, we have our contractors come out and address them.
Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
Just in terms of count of your close to 200 incidences, how many of those are encampments?
Those will be we actually track in, there are two ways, so I would have a hard time giving you exactly that amount. Roughly about 5% of our calls were bacteria related, and that would be where that would be categorized. However, we do have an encampment button on our services that goes to our operations and maintenance team. So it may there may be some that go directly to that encampment button, as well as the flood control district has dedicated inspectors where their sole role is to look for the beginnings of encampments. They are monitoring, you know, they're going along all of our flood control channels looking for signs of encampment establishment. And then once they see that happening, we have an outreach team and a sheriff. We've got a response team that comes out. They make contact with the folks who are there, and then our O&M team comes in and clean. You know, once the people are hopefully connected with services, our O&M team comes and responds, cleans up the area, and most likely repairs the fence or whatever the issue was for the beginning of the encampment. Believe it or not, this is Rainbow Lane. Literally, this happened on Rainbow Lane. This was a residential paint spill where the homeowner's young son knocked over a 5-gallon bucket of red paint in the back of their truck. And I think his panicked response to having 5 gallons of red paint in his truck bed was to hose it out. And then I think you can see where perhaps all of a sudden you would go, that was not a good move. We responded here. We have also identified through this process sewage and storm drain cross connections. This was not in your region. This was in North County, but there was a connection actually that we fear was a long-term connection, but was identified and corrected. And then also,
Amanda, mm-hmm. Real quick, can you inform the board, how did you make that determination that there might have been a cross connection?
We identified through visual evidence that there was most likely sewage coming out of a storm drain. We then went up the storm drain, were able to identify a connection into the main box channel of where it was coming from. It was going to a single facility. We then worked with the city to get those construction plans, went through that investigative process, and were able to identify where there was a missed connection during the construction of the building. And it was a, luckily it wasn't a constant, I mean, part of the reason why it took so long to identify was because it was in an area that didn't, the toilets in that area weren't used on a daily basis. And so it wasn't a constant discharge. It was a very intermittent discharge. But once it was identified and we were able to trace it back up, we did find a cross connection that was then, they had to go in and undo. And this resulted, as you were talking about, you know, this did result in enforcement. This did result in a long-term project. This facility now actually has a on-site environmental coordinator, which they didn't previously have, but that was all part of the settlement process. They also adopted, we have an Adopt-a-Channel program, which is sort of similar to the Adopt-a-Highway concept. They adopted this section of channel. There were a lot of steps, but they were also, there were enforcement actions that were taken. Fire runoff is a big big potential source and one of our more challenging issues to deal with. So this was a metal plating fire, which again is a pretty nasty fire to deal with and resulted in impacts to the channel that we were able to respond to and address. And actually, I'll walk you through, I think, I'll take you through one of our bigger responses just after this. But in general, even though all of these are different situations, we handle them in generally the same manner. Once we have an incident reported and we locate that incident, we go downstream as quickly as possible to find the extent of where, how far that incident has reached, and we set up downstream containment. We then call in a contractor. They come in, they've got the Vactor trucks, they've got the, you know, all of the necessary contracting in place to deal with hazardous to non-hazardous waste disposal. They will come in and collect the water, and then we will, you know, restore the area as much as possible back to the original conditions. So that's a basic, in a big picture scheme, three easy steps. But like I said, each incident is unique and has its own challenges. One of the major ones that we have dealt with recently was we, again, had another metal plating shop fire, which actually, let me take you through. This is the day after. Of course, it happens at night. So it's a fire, the metal plating fire at night. We were alerted to the situation by the fire department. This is what it looked like the following day. You can see where we've bermed at the front here, and we're containing as much of the fire runoff on site as possible. But during the incident itself, which started, you can see it up here in the top right corner. It was the Omni Metal finishing plant. This is a channel here, but the runoff went through the underground storm drain system. We were able to capture downstream containment right at the end of the red line there, which looked like, oh, hold on, which looked like this. So based on that interactive mapping that we had, we were able to, our contractor was able to go to the furthest downstream point. We also had monitoring that was being done looking for, you know, basic indicators of impact, turbidity, pH, because we're needing to do this in the field live. This is not stuff that we can send out to the lab to say, hey, can you give me a reading on this? This is what we can do with test kits in the situation where we determined at this point in the downstream system, the fire runoff had not yet impacted. So they were able to get into the storm drain, set up containment within the storm drain to make sure that the water was stopped at that point. And then they were able to, where did my picture go? All of these are storage tanks where the water was then captured
and pumped and held in these tanks, which kept it from moving downstream here into Fountain Valley Channel, and then down here is the Bolsa Chica wetlands. So if this fire runoff, if this metal, heavy metal laden fire suppression runoff had made it, it would have gone into some very sensitive habitat. So this was held on site in these Baker tanks for a significant period of time until it could be correctly characterized, and then it was sent off site for disposal at an appropriate facility. So this was a really good example of when everything goes right, even though everything is going wrong with a metal plating fire in the middle of the night. But we were able to get out and respond and make sure that it didn't have really significant downstream impacts. So just want to call out, this is my team, Kim Buss, who was my detail information source during our conversation, is here in the audience. Grant and I have spent many, many a year on our spill response team in his previous roles at the county. He and I have spent some quality time overnight at some very interesting incidences over the years. But we have five folks who are fully trained and responding, and we have five waiting in the wings, and we kind of rotate our folks through depending on whether or not you have little ones at home or what stage of life you're in, depends on whether or not you can respond, after hours or not. So we like to have a lot of flexibility within our staff, but this is our process. We're really dedicated to it. I'm very proud of the services that we provide. I think we have a lot of in-house dedication and expertise to address some pretty interesting challenges and work them all the way through the system, which I know is a lot of what your team does as well. So it's hopefully you feel good knowing that it's also done at the local level. And that's all I have.
Any other questions? I think we've been asking them to go along.
What was the cost for the metal plating fire cleanup?
Oh no, cost. How much did they clean up? That was about $500,000. Yeah. Yeah. Ultimately about $300,000.
$375,000?
Yeah, $300,000. Well, roughly $300,000.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah. Almost always those big ones come at the end of the fiscal year and then create a lot of paperwork challenges. But yeah.
Oh, question. Mm-hmm. So we consolidated for MS4 permits and things like that. Do all of the counties have these types of groups that have been pulled together?
I don't think so. I think Orange County is reasonably unique in the collective nature of its NPDES program. We started out that way, which I think was a big help. I think it also helps that our geographic area is reasonably contiguous. We're a pretty manageable, a mere 700 square miles. We're pretty well developed. We're pretty interrelated in our connections of our systems and our jurisdictional boundaries. So we've always operated that way. But I'm not particularly aware of if there are other counties that do it.
So I have one other. I can add to that. It was because of Orange County's cooperation and coordination that it served as the model for when the state was looking at how to roll this out. So what we are seeing in other counties, people trying to get to that point, and there's a lot of reasons why they're not able to get to that point. It does require, a certain level of capital investment that a lot of counties just don't have. A lot of counties just don't have continuous development like Orange County does. So there's a lot of things that make it more difficult. But Orange County, I believe, is still kind of looked at as the number one model of how to have an emergency response for spills. So congratulations.
Thank you. All right.
Jen?
Well, I just want to congratulate you, and I love the fact that you're able to scale this program. It's just, and then the collaboration that's happening. So congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. And I will also give kudos to my wastewater partners. You know, those are the spills that we don't have any qualms about in the sense of how to address it, because we've got good capability on both sides. In general, for wastewater spills, all we're doing is opening the gates so they can get to channels, you know, to our facilities, because the wastewater agencies are on it and know how to address those issues. So we're in partnership in support, both from a, hey, do you need to know where the mapping is? Hey, do you need, you know, what help can we provide? But as Board Member Cantu was mentioning, you know, it is based on a long-term partnership. We've been working together a long time. We know who to call. You know, our responders, everybody is working in these environmental crimes task forces. You know, we're crossing paths quite a bit, and we do a lot of cross-training and information sharing. So it's a really good system. All right. Thanks so much.
Anybody else? Thank you. Next up, we have an information item on from Santa Margarita Water District and Moulton Niguel Water District. And Fasayo or Brandon, you're going to introduce it. Thank you.
Yes. Excuse me, Chair. We need to ask for public comments on the previous item, I believe.
Oh, I'm sorry. Were there any comments or questions from the public on the previous information item? None?
I don't see any hands online. Thank you.
No? Right. Thank you.
Here we go. Hi, Board Chair Strawn and fellow members of the board. My name is Brandon Bushnell. I'm a water resource control engineer working at the San Diego Water Board in the Water Sustainability and Protection Unit. Today, I have the honor of introducing Santa Margarita Water District and Moulton Niguel Water District as they present on some updates to their water supply and diversification projects. We'll start off with Santa Margarita Water District. Here today, we have General Manager Robert Grantham, their Chief Engineer Tricia Butler, as well as their hydrogeologist Mike Blazovic to give this presentation.
I promise I will take only 30 seconds to say thank you, Chair, members of the board, and also thank you to State Board Member Nicole Morgan. It's always wonderful to see her. Thank you for your support, and thank you for your collaboration. South County, I think, is a hallmark of environmental stewardship. Recycled water has just been part of our water supply since the beginning. Santa Margarita, we recycle majority of our wastewater, and it really is a key component to our water portfolio. As Brandon noted, you know, really we need to make sure we have a diversified water portfolio. We import water from 500, 600 miles away, and we like to use that water as often as possible. I'd like to also acknowledge our board president, who's vice chair, Betty Olson, and also Lindsay Leahy, who is our new deputy general manager and was the one that delivered Pure Water Oceanside. And so this has really been a team collaboration. So the district, we have been innovative. We developed the Lake Mission Viejo Advanced Water Treatment, the first human contact of recycled water, advanced treated water. Last drought, the governor at the time, Governor Brown, said, "I'm sorry, we really shouldn't be putting potable water in that lake." And so it was a collaboration, a public-private partnership, where we were able to actually provide water to maintain the aesthetic of the community, but do so in an environmental way. Mike, who's going to give this presentation, along with Tricia and the team, have been working on diversified water portfolios, stormwater. Can we take our groundwater and turn it into drinking water? Can we take stormwater, turn it into drinking water? And thank you to Brandon and Dave Gibson, the Department of Drinking Water, Division of Drinking Water, and envisioning an idea for IPR, indirect potable reuse, so turning our recycled water into a reliable and environmental stewardship, turning that into drinking water. To that end, we've received over $30 million to put that vision into practice. And I would like to invite you all to come visit on another time and be honored to have you. And with that, I'll turn it over to the brains of the operation, Mike. Thank you.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. I'm Mike Blazevich, again, hydrogeologist with the district. And just again, thank you for having me and having the district here to present on the project we're calling the Middle San Juan Basin Recharge and Reuse Project. And it's really two projects. It's the Ranch Water Filtration Plant and the Rienda Infiltration Basins. And I'll go over both of them. And the reason why we have sort of two projects here is it's a very integrated project, as well as our system overall. A lot of engineering, a lot of thought has been put into this project and conceptually how we can do IPR. So in terms of presentation, just to give a little overview, just give you a high level of the project, what the project entails, location, talk a little bit about the project challenges, which I think are pretty important to identify and talk through what those challenges are. And I'll highlight some of the project benefits, which I think are really, really important, and then talk a little bit about how we can overcome those challenges. So let me just advance a little bit here. Okay, just for orientation purposes, Santa Margarita, South Orange County. The black boundaries or the black polygons more or less represents the San Juan Creek watershed, the major drainage being the San Juan Creek coming off the Santa Ana Mountains. The sort of individual black polygons, those are the different hydrologic sub-areas. And then the orange or the yellow boundary represent Santa Margarita's service area. The Rienda Infiltration Basins are located in the Middle San Juan HSA, and then the future Ranch Water Filtration Plant is located in the Cañada Chiquita HSA. So same map. What I did here in overlay in yellow is the rough boundary of our groundwater basin, and it is considered a coastal groundwater basin. And I think similar to a lot of basins along the coast, it's shallow, it's alluvial. Typically poor water quality, high salts, TDS, chlorides. We have a lot of iron and manganese in our water. These are challenges for, I think, a lot of coastal basins. The other major challenge for us is that the basin, because it's shallow, narrow, there's not a lot of storage. There's not a lot of groundwater we can pump year in and year out. We do have to rely on Mother Nature to allow rainfall to come down onto the ground, infiltrate, and recharge the basin. So it's a really dynamic basin in terms of storage. And then urbanization, of course, really challenging when we're thinking about putting in major facilities, putting in a groundwater well, let alone a recharge basin, really challenging because of just the land use restraints. Okay, so this is kind of more of a focused location of our project area, and this is kind of within the Middle San Juan HSA for the most part. And what I'm trying to do with this image, and I apologize if it's a little blurry, but I want to highlight that a lot of work and a lot of engineering has been done to put in a lot of facilities to make this future project work. And so I'll just kind of walk through kind of conceptually of how a project like this would work when we're talking about introducing recycled water into a basin. So one here, number one, that's the location of our Chiquita Water Reclamation Plant. That's where we're producing tertiary treated recycled water. Recycled water goes out from Chiquita within our distribution system, goes to our different reservoirs. For this particular project, it can come down this existing purple pipe along what's called Cow Camp Road, transect the Rienda infiltration basins shown as number 4, and then we can pump it up to Trampas, which is our 5,000 acre feet seasonal storage reservoir for recycled water. From Trampas, that water can go to the infiltration basins. And so what we envision, the recycled water that could be spread at the infiltration basins would would likely be a blend of water coming directly from Chiquita, but most of it would probably be coming from the stored recycled water at Trampas. And once the water is spread at the recharge basin, it's going to infiltrate vertically, right? And then it's going to move horizontally, sort of in the direction of what I'm showing as a blue line. That's really the San Juan Creek. It's going to follow that same flow path. That's the direction of the surface water flow. That's the direction of groundwater flow. And the water will keep moving and get picked up by at least three source wells for the ranch filtration plant. These are existing wells in the basin owned by RMV at the current time. That water then would get extracted and pumped up through repurposed lines up to right next to or adjacent to Chiquita is the ranch filtration plant, the future water filtration plant, where we would treat the water, meet all drinking water standards, and again, moved up through existing pipelines to our existing potable reservoir. So a lot of facilities have already been built. The Rienda infiltration basins themselves have more or less been constructed. Let me get to that. Okay. So this is just an oblique view of the Rienda infiltration basins. Oops, I went. Sorry, it's kind of a, okay, yeah, here we go. So oblique view of the infiltration basins and just kind of how they would work is the orange arrows represent where the stormwater and dry weather flow would be directed into these sort of cement line forebays. The water then would either spill or we can potentially move the water out of the sort of forebays and into what we're calling a pre-treatment basin. This is probably going to be some sort of vegetated low flow channel with the goal of just trying to drop off some of the sediments that's in the stormwater and dry weather, probably do some nutrient removal because of the vegetated channel. What we envision is sort of like a distribution hub with probably some additional filtration, again, to just remove some of those sediments and then be able to move them in either cell. And we're really thinking about how we can improve the stormwater, really for water quality purposes, but in terms of just maintenance and longevity of the basin, prevent the basins from clogging, reduce the amount of maintenance we have to do within the basins themselves.
I can ask a question. Is it basically gravity flow to this point, and then you have to pump it up to the reservoir?
The purple pipe, I think there's enough pressure, Tricia, maybe correct me as an engineer, we can, from Chiquita, it will get pumped up to Trampas at this point. We won't be pumping right here.
I'm just wondering how much of an energy
question.
Input you have to.
Yes, that is true. The recycled water that's coming out of Chiquita is getting pumped all the way to Trampas. The groundwater that gets infiltrated here will be flowing through the groundwater basin until the groundwater pumps pump it up to the ranch plant.
How much of a rise is that?
It's about, from the basins to the plant is about 200 feet.
Okay, so I'm just trying to think of an energy requirement here for pumping. You do a lot of that at night or solar? Or
We would have some ability, at the pumping to the recycled water can take into consideration time of day. A lot of the usage will go by gravity out of the plant and then up into the Trampas Reservoir. We pump that into reservoirs throughout our system, and we can do that at the best time-efficient times because we have enough storage to handle a day's worth of demands.
Chair Strawn, if we could get that speaker to introduce their name for the record.
Yes, I forgot to ask you. We need your name, if you state it for the record.
Thank you. I'm Tricia Butler, and I'm the chief engineer of the Santa Margarita Water District. Thank you.
I think I have a video of the basins. A lot of drone footage was taken by RMV, Rancho Mission Viejo. Let's see if I can get there. There's a delay. I think I'll skip that video. Like,
does he need to point that to a particular direction to get the slides to move forward?
I don't know if it's because of a video.
This remote doesn't seem to be. Get some help there. Thank you.
Yeah, there you go. There's our two four bays, stormwater, dry weather flow would come into, a little bit of a delay, and water would move through what we're calling the pretreatment basin, likely going to be maybe a low flow vegetated channel, distribution hub to further filter the water, and then move between cells. And having the different cells gives us some flexibility to be introducing water and do maintenance in one basin and just kind of keep the operation going. And then over to the right here, this is in our facility. This is the county's flood control facility. So all of the recycled water recharge spreading, surface water spreading would be in these two basins right here. Okay, so the project for us, we broke it up into phases, and not so much like construction phases, but really water source. And so for phase one, we're just looking at groundwater in terms of a project, just taking native groundwater from the basin and sending it to the ranch filtration plant. And that range is between 800 and 2000. And this is potable, like product water. There's some reduction from raw groundwater going into the basin, brine reject, that stuff that's getting sent out to the outfall. Phase two is a combination of groundwater and surface water runoff that's going to come into the basins, and the surface water consists of both surface water or storm flow and dry weather flow. And then phase three is the combination of the groundwater, surface water, and recycled water. And so the range, if we're just looking at groundwater on the low end of 800, we'd like to be able to get at least 5,000 acre feet of recycled water, but that's going to be dependent on how the basins take the infiltration, any downstream impacts to that amount of recycled water. Okay, so project benefits. We do think the project is aligned with several components of the governor's strategy for a hotter and drier California. Certainly a project like this would reduce imported demands, generate a new local water supply. Like I said, being able to introduce recycled water as a form of managed aquifer recharge would help stabilize the groundwater basin, so we're not so dependent on dry weather or wet weather, and that if we go through 3 or 4 months, a year of dry conditions, we have enough groundwater, augmented groundwater, to support our wells, to support the ranch filtration plant. Reduces excess recycled water discharge. I think our the way we operate now, very little, if any, from our wastewater plants discharges go into the ocean. With the ranch filtration plant, and we do have the San Juan groundwater plant, there is the brine reject that goes out into the outfall. And that's about 20 to 30% of the raw groundwater that comes into the plant. That's usually about the reject percentage that will get sent out to the outfall. The SNMP, the recent SNMP that got approved, did talk about the ranch filtration plant as a benefit in terms of improving water quality in this part of the basin, in that we know the TDS is high with the groundwater, but with the ranch filtration plant, treating the water to TDS levels below imported water concentrations. And then as that water gets moved throughout the sewer shed, used up and sent back to Chiquita, that TDS would be lower. And then ultimately with time, the groundwater basin should receive a benefit in terms of that improved water quality. Robert mentioned we did receive over $30 million in grants, both for the ranch filtration plant and the Rienda infiltration basin. Just also to put into a little perspective that we have been talking to DDW and Regional Water Quality Control Board staff about this project. We started, I think, in maybe early to mid 2023. Just really introducing the project to the staff. Conceptually, we had more than a couple different ideas of different areas we can recharge, different ways of introducing the recharge. We had, I guess, more detailed conversation in early 2024, honing in on what the project's going to look like, how the regulations are going to impact us, and how we can work through the regulations. And then in 2024, we did have the privilege of meeting with one of the State Water Resources Control Board board members, some of the DDW staff, again, to just talk about the project, some of the challenges we're seeing with the regulations as written, and then come up with a project plan going forward. So challenges, it really comes down to water quality. A lot of work and a lot of monitoring has been done in the Middle San Juan HSA to show that the majority of the groundwater basin is impaired. High TDS, over 1,000 milligrams per liter concentration. There's iron and manganese that are challenging, and we see that throughout the basin. We also have PFAS that's been detected in several wells throughout the basin. And the recycled water, our TOC is a little high. Our total nitrogen is a little high. I call out nitrates and nitrites. At times, those can be close to or right at the MCL. And there is PFAS. We have sampled and seen PFAS in our wastewater. So let me just back up. Right now, as is, you know, the groundwater needs treatment as a municipal supply. It's really Santa Margarita that's going to have two treatment plants with the ranch filtration plant. We have a future North Open Space that probably a well site that's going to need treatment. And then further down, there's South Coast Water District, who also has RO treatment to deal with groundwater that's, in our opinion, impaired. In terms of a project path forward, when we're looking at being able to introduce recycled water into the basin, understanding that as the regulations are written, we don't meet all of the requirements, namely for TOC and total nitrogen. But we are going to seek the alternative sections within the GRRP regulations. And with the alternative sections, we're basically bringing on an independent scientific panel to look at our project, to look at what we're proposing as an alternative to meet the intent of the regulations, to meet public health safety goals as intended by the regulations. And so big picture and what we're seeking with the alternatives is rather than meeting the compliance or meeting the monitoring for the recycled water going into the basins, allow that recycled water to be spread onto the basins. We will track it through a pretty robust monitoring network. But ultimately, the ranch filtration plant would be responsible for meeting the drinking water standards and all the water quality requirements within the GRRP. And just to highlight, it's important we do establish a well control zone that a public or a private entity can't go into this area between where we're going to infiltrate water and where we're going to extract it, put in a well, and say, hey, I'm going to serve it. We will need to establish that well control zone. And as part of the SNMP that we're continuing to monitor and a lot of the work that's been done to support the SNMP, I think we have a pretty robust monitoring network that we can really understand and track not only baseline conditions in terms of water quality, but how this project could impact water quality. And then project schedule, just to kind of put things in perspective of timelines, I broke it up into kind of the three phases I talked about in terms of source water. But the construction and permitting of the plant and wells, that's going to take us all the way into mid-2028. The re-end infiltration basins, that's our early phase two, those are already built, but the district is looking to enhance some of those features, like I mentioned, the vegetative flow channel, maybe additional filtration, again, to improve the surface water. And we think that's going to take us probably into 2026. And then really the recycled water recharge and the Title 22 engineering report. We've been doing a lot of work in terms of data collection. We've drafted several sections of the text. We're getting ready to hand it off to, or issue an RFP to bring on a consultant to help us complete the Title 22 report, look at the design features of the ranch filtration plant. We think that process in terms of a pretty good draft final Title 22 report will take us into 2026. At that point, we'll hand it off to DDW's Recycled Water Division and Regional Quality Control Board, and they'll work through the Title 22 report and work with us to answer questions, make refinements, things of that nature. And we think probably a healthy year review time between DDW and Regional Water Quality Control Board is what we're anticipating to put us in 2027. I think with that, I'm done. Robert.
One final comment, and a little short of the mic. Thank you for your support, and in particular, thank you for your staff support in this process as we evaluate. And this is, as we look, and our board has this vision of where we're going to go from a diversified water portfolio, and Tricia's guidance and Mike's guidance, and part of what we need to do is consider the economics. And what does this project represent? Represents a public-private partnership. Those basins were a requirement for the water quality management plan. The developer built, constructed, must maintain in order to meet their own requirements. It's an opportunity for the partnership where we can share in that process and take advantage of something to, you know, truly, from an economically viable perspective, you know, have a local water supply. And it's an impaired basin, and so it's a chance to also clean up that basin. And then if this phase works, there's potentially future phases that we can continue to expand our turning recycled water into a viable drinking water supply. So the art of the possible is here. And I just thank you to Mike and thank you to the board for the time.
Questions?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. So can I assume that this is indirect portable use? And the reason why you want that is you could benefit by discharging into the aquifer.
That's right.
Because the regulation for direct portable is the state finished with the direct portable? Yeah. So you wouldn't want to do that because you get killing two birds with one stone, cleaning.
We're probably going to consider a DPR later on. I think as part of our RFP, we're looking at maybe the feasibility of what would we need to do and what the economics are. But sort of the maybe low-hanging fruit is to do IPR really for the reasons of recharging the basin, having a supply to go to the ranch filtration plant in the interim until we figure out if DPR is right for us.
I think this is great. Thank you for the presentation today. And I guess two related questions. First, how much was done? How much of this project, the ideas that you've presented today, did you see elsewhere and then bring to make work or bring to bear so that it worked for your basin? And then relatedly, and whether that's in California or abroad, because we're obviously not the only folks struggling with limited water supply. And then what are the plans to share out the best practices or the learnings that you've had along the way? As again, this issue is only going to come up for more regional entities in California.
Yeah, I mean, we have over the years, Santa Margarita, the San Juan Basin Authority have looked at this basin and looked for opportunities to do recharge, really because of the challenges with the basin. But there are not only the urbanization challenges, but hydrogeologically or geologically, groundwater is high in some locations. That's a challenge of how much water you can put into the ground because of just the physical space of being able to put recycled water. So this is one area in the basin where there's a pretty good separation between where the groundwater table is and where the bottom of the basins are. So we're kind of challenged in that, and I would suspect other areas that have a coastal aquifer may see similar challenges of being able to do a project like this. You know, as we go through the Title 22 process and as we get through the completion, I think we're going to learn a lot more about the project and how recycled water recharge would impact groundwater, surface flow, things of that nature. And as time progresses, yeah, we would love to be able to share regionally, statewide, what we learn with the project. Maybe even through navigating the regulations, you know, the conversations we're having. I think that's all on the table for us to be able to discuss and share.
Someone here will have to remind me which nation spoke to us at the WQCC several years ago, but it's just, we're Denmark. Yeah. So we had representatives from Denmark, and because they're dealing with so many similar issues that we are. Yeah. And so I guess I hope that we're not trying to reinvent the wheel every time and taking the learnings, and because, you know, you're talking about the impaired groundwater that you're working with. That was one of the big issues in Denmark. And to talk about the public understanding of what you put on in your lawn or put on the street ends up in your drinking water is so far beyond what we have in the state of California that it just feels like we're, you know, we should be more, we should encourage more folks to look for those who have already tackled these issues.
Yeah, that's a good comment.
Just so you know, Singapore does 100% of their water. Chair, I have one more question, if I may. Of course, I forgot it. I'll come back to it.
Yeah, we'll come back to you. Go ahead.
If I can cap up on this, you mentioned Singapore. So the person that was instrumental in working on the Singapore program was also the same person who worked on the GWRS, the Orange County Sanitation District, Orange County Water District, groundwater recharge system. So it's one big brain implementing these things. And you know, obviously, that's a very salient, influential project. You know, won a huge international water award in Stockholm. And so not only does South Orange County benefit from that knowledge, but all the world does benefit from that knowledge.
Yeah, and we've reached out to Orange County Water District, IUA, folks that are really instrumental in driving out the regulations look like. And so they have so much institutional knowledge that's been beneficial in kind of how we think about the project, how we look at the regulations, how we think about monitoring. So, I don't want to think we're starting from the beginning. I think a lot of work has been done in Southern California, and we're doing our best to leverage that knowledge.
One of the things that I thought it'd be worthwhile to mention, you had the numbers for the yields of water.
Yeah.
And I think it might be good to say what percentage of our drinking water supply that would represent after treatment. And I think your highest volume was 4,000.
Yeah. So the max that we were sort of envisioning in this phase three with recycled water, we think about 5,000 acre feet will go to the ranch filtration plant with like a 20% loss would bring the number I showed of 4,000. And that 1,000 acre feet is the brine, waste, and reject that goes out to the ocean outfall.
And I think that it's important to kind of know, from my standpoint, is this project is valuable because it shows us we have to meet drinking water as well as degradation of a basin. And so they're not sort of intertwined. They're two separate units that you deal with. And I think the more that the regional boards can help facilitate so it's one smooth process is helpful.
May I, Vice Chair Olson, we have a mantra at Santa Margarita, go do great things. And so exactly to that point, it's our responsibility as the larger agencies to innovate, work on the regulations, and then share, whether it's in California or beyond. I really appreciate that question. It's also not just a technology or a regulatory issue. It's also sharing for the common person why this is such an important source of supply, and to the question, our drinking water demands are about 33,000 acre feet. With our groundwater plant in San Juan, we're over 5,000 acre feet. This could be another 4,000 acre feet. So, what's our goal locally? To have 30% local supply. Where does that come from? We have a public health and safety requirement. I'm also an environmentalist, card carrying, and we also have to protect the economic viability of our community. We serve a very critical role, and we're in the chamber of one of our partners, the city. And so this helps us get to that local supply so we have indoor water demands and can serve our commercial customers. And so that's the vision of the board that we at staff are implementing, and that's why that's such an important question. This helps us to get to that sustainable indoor supply in case of the all-out emergency, and it fits very much with our strategic objective. So I just wanted to add a little bit of color. Thank you.
Chair, I remember my question, and he just answered all of it. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Perfect. Thank you.
Any other questions from the board? from the public, both in person and online. Do we have any comments or questions? Hearing none, I'll say thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And Brandon, we welcome you back. I think the key point of the basins is they're massive. And so
yeah,
they feel different in person.
Thank you. You want to introduce our next speaker, Brandon? Thank you.
Can we get the PowerPoint? Yeah, perfect. Next, we'll have Moulton Niguel Water District. And with here today, we have their board director, Dwayne Cave, as well as their director of infrastructure and reuse, David Larson, and their water resource manager, Laura Rocha, will be presenting to you guys today on their project.
Well, thank you very much. My name is Dwayne Cave. I serve as board president for Moulton Niguel Water District. And on behalf of our entire board, we're very happy to be here before you to discuss our Oasis Water Resource Center. We're grateful to the Regional Water Quality Board for their ongoing leadership to protect our community from urban runoff, pollution, and other contaminants here in South Orange County. We enjoy clean beaches, creeks, and watersheds because of the outstanding work that you all do. Moulton Niguel is committed to building a resilient water future for South Orange County. We believe that our water resiliency efforts are critical for the benefit of our customers. As a retail agency with no groundwater basin, we are committed to proactive efforts to expand potable use. At the forefront of our effort is the Oasis Water Resource Center, which envisions a sustainable future through the creation of a local water supplies while fostering improvements in watershed health. Before I hand it over to our experts, Laura and Dave, I just want to again say thank you very much for having us here today, and we truly look forward to working with all of you as we move forward with this project. So thank you very much.
Well, good morning still, almost noon, but my name is David Larson. I'm Director of Infrastructure and Reuse, and really a pleasure to be here, and I'll try to weave in some of the questions and comments in our discussion as well. So a little bit about what we're going to talk about today, really just kind of provide an update on our OASIS program and upcoming efforts, as well as an overview and a schedule for what we're trying to accomplish. Part of that is through our direct potable reuse planning studies. We envision a pilot associated with that direct potable reuse system, and then also an urban runoff diversion study that we'll get into as well. And so we'll talk about that. A little bit about Moulton Niguel Water District. We are in South Orange County. We serve potable, recycled, and wastewater services to about 170,000 customers. Serving six cities, portions of Mission Viejo, portions of San Juan Capistrano, Dana Point, and then Aliso Viejo, Laguna Niguel, and Laguna Hills. Our Director Cave is our board president. We also have a total board of seven elected officials that kind of choose our direction and really guide us in our goals. And one of the things we like to, I don't know, brag about, but really we try to be innovative. We try to come up with innovative solutions in looking out for our customers as we go forward. So a little bit about background. This program really started in 2021 with a potable, actually started long before that, but I'll circle back to that in a minute. Our potable reuse study really looked at, with the pending regulations in the state, what wastewater could be available to produce direct potable reuse and potable water. As Director Cave mentioned, we have no viable groundwater basin in our service area, and I'll show a map in just a moment. And so really looking at ways to be resilient and create local water supplies. So then in 2022, we met with the regional board. We met with staff and we met with the board itself and talked about this program. At the time, it was called RAIN, and things have evolved a little bit since that time. But, you know, Dave Gibson actually mentioned that he's really excited for this program and looks for this project to be the first direct potable reuse facility in the San Diego Basin and potentially even the state. A lot of work on that end, and again, I'll wrap that up as well. So in 2024, we received some grant funding to support our initial studies, and we met with Division of Drinking Water to talk about the program with them and get their feedback, and they actually also commented that they're excited about this project and excited about the program. And so now here we are in 2025, we've contracted with several firms to support our efforts in this program. Some of them are here today, and I'll touch on that as well. And then we're starting on the direct potable reuse regulatory process as we go. So tapping into our team, you know, obviously a program of this nature is really driven by our board of directors. And so they're at the pinnacle of our team for this. From there, we have an internal team of 6 to 10 different individuals that are really championing different pillars of this program. It's the size of this program is something that no one person can manage on their own. So we do have a very deep bench and great team in support of this. Now, along those lines, we also have quite a few consultants that are partners as we go forward with this. We hired Black & Veatch based on their global water reuse portfolio. They serve as our program manager, guiding us through, keeping us on schedule, keeping us on task. Some of the board members talked about the Orange County Water District, and we brought on Pure Water Consultants as a strategic advisor. That firm is comprised of previous general managers from Orange County Water District and Orange County Sand. So I really value their support in guiding us through this process as well. And then we brought on GeoSyntec and Corollo to serve as our consultants doing the legwork on the urban runoff diversion study, as well as the direct potable reuse study. And as you can imagine, with direct potable reuse, outreach and community engagement is essential. And so we're still in the selection process for bringing on probably multiple firms for the outreach and communication to really reach into our community and understand and educate the community on what we're really trying to do. So along those lines, you can see some of our partners on this slide. One of the key contributors is the County of Orange. You know, we've worked with the county for over a decade in the Aliso Creek in their efforts to measure the quantity and quality of water in the Aliso Creek. And they're one of the key contributors in developing the overall program. But we've also got MOUs with LADWP. They see us as kind of a streamline of helping their efforts. And so we're trying to learn from them, they're trying to learn from us, as well as several others along the way. One of the things I will mention as well is we have a relationship with the Kingdom of Denmark, and we're actually hosting a few of their staff, Aarhusvand actually, we're hosting them next week, and we're trying to learn from them with their rewater program, and they're trying to learn from us and some of the things we're doing. So it's really been a positive relationship there. So as an overview, high level, and feel free to interrupt me and ask questions as we go, hoping this can be a dialogue. As you can see on the map on the right, the Aliso Creek watershed is outlined in blue, and the Multnagel service area is kind of shaded in orange. We cover a good portion of that Aliso Creek watershed, and so with that, we're really looking to champion with the county in creating sustainability in our community with a new drinking water source, as well as improving the environment within the Aliso Creek and reducing ocean discharges through the outfall from treated wastewater. So a little bit about our current water reuse practices. We've had a recycled water program since 1968. We've been doing it for quite a while, and so it currently makes up about 25% of our total water demand. So this direct potable reuse facility is really looking to expand that local supply to about 30%. So currently the water, as you, I'm sure you are very well aware, the water from homes and businesses goes to the treatment plant, goes through a tertiary treatment process, and then in our service area, it's used for landscape, irrigation, medians, slopes, things of those natures. So what we're looking to do with direct potable reuse is really create that new drinking water supply. Now, one of the key components is taking that tertiary treated wastewater and really doing some advanced purification to that water. Part of the benefits of us as a smaller agency is that we have control of our wastewater. We, from a source control standpoint, we've got good quality wastewater, as odd as that may sound. So one of the streamline thought processes that we're trying to implement here is we're planning on following the prescribed treatment train from the regulations that the Division of Drinking Water outlined. That really saves us some time, and at the size of facilities that we're talking about, it kind of makes it more efficient. We don't need to work on all the different alternatives of processes there. And so really what we're looking at is somewhere between a 3 and a 5 million gallon a day facility for our direct potable reuse supply. Now on to the urban runoff diversion. So one of the things that the county has identified is the Aliso Creek watershed has non-native flow. And there's been some study of that already, but really we're trying to nail down what is that non-native flow and is there benefit to the watershed of pulling excess water out of that, out of the creek. Now what we're talking about doing is pulling that water out and introducing that into our recycled water system. From a direct potable reuse perspective, we don't want to have a source control issue. So we really want to take that urban runoff out of the creek and put it into our recycled water system and preserve that water quality of the wastewater. So as a combined system for the overall program, really the benefit of the Aliso Creek watershed, not only to the environment, but also to the direct potable reuse facility, is any water that is pulled from the creek and introduced into the recycled water system really makes more wastewater available for the direct potable reuse facility, which would ultimately be potable water for our customers. Now, from an area perspective, this program is really centered around the Laguna Niguel Regional Park. And you can see in the center of the picture there, the Laguna Niguel Lake. So what is proposed is on the lower left portion of the picture is the runoff diversion study area. From a proximity standpoint, Aliso Creek runs very close to some of our existing infrastructure. So we're looking at potentially building a urban runoff diversion from the creek, repurposing some existing pipelines, and running that water up to a natural treatment system up in the upper right-hand corner as it goes into the Laguna Niguel Lake. From there, nominal treatment would be applied, and that water would be implemented into the recycled water system. Now, from there, the direct potable reuse facility is shown on the right side of the slide. If I can actually point to it here. Kind of hard to see because of the color of the background. But near the regional treatment plant. And then one of the things, as I mentioned before, with the outreach and communications, we really do think that an education facility, and I'm looking to share the site location with some of you on this tour, there's really a benefit for the education center.
Is that a natural lake or is it a reservoir?
It is a managed reservoir, but it is fed by urban runoff from the Sulphur Creek watershed that leads into. There's actually three separate creeks that kind of join into this area. So part of the conversation is the urban runoff that would be diverted from the Aliso Creek watershed would be introduced into the urban runoff that's feeding into the Sulphur Creek. So we haven't finished our studies, of course, but we do believe that the water quality within the lake will actually improve with more water going through it. So, and with the implementation of a natural treatment system, that's something we're looking into as well.
Where on this map did you say the existing pipeline infrastructure exists?
So the, hard to see in this particular slide, but the blue pipeline that runs from the bottom of the creek, from here all the way up.
So it does already exist.
Along the leak. Right. So we actually have a project, a separate project, to replace some sewer force mains within the park. And so the idea is to repurpose one of those old sewer force mains and use it for this purpose. Line it, make sure it's structurally sound and that type of thing, but then repurpose that pipeline, minimizing the impact of the park, the users, everything else. So overall timeline, you know, as I mentioned, we're in the study phase of things. Although we've been working on this since about 2022, we show from last year and into this year, we've initiated our studies for both direct potable reuse as well as the urban runoff diversion. And then we're anticipating constructing a direct potable reuse pilot plant, likely to be located at our headquarters to kind of serve as an education piece with our community. But we're looking to initiate that next year and ultimately getting into final design in the 2028 timeframe. Because of the size and complexity of the project, we are anticipating design to be several years with construction leading into construction in about 2030 and finishing in about 2033. Because of the regulations, we do anticipate about a year of demonstration to basically prove out all the regulations that the treatment system works and it is safe, and then ultimately operation in about 2035. And with that, I'll turn it over to Laura Rocha to talk a little bit about the details. Yes.
Before you turn over, can I assume that you are in discussion or talk to San Diego's second phase of the Pure Water, because you guys are running parallel?
Very much so, and we're actually visiting them on Friday to tour their facility and touch base with them. So it is a very small community of, especially in Orange County, in Southern California, all the different types of facilities and the different pilots that they're running. So we are very much trying to learn from each other and not duplicate efforts.
Yeah, I saw your timeline. It's almost the same as theirs, second phase.
Precisely.
Good afternoon. My name is Laura Rocha. I'm a water resources manager at Molten Niguel Water District, and I'm here to talk a little bit about the planning studies that we are embarking on. So the first study that we're embarking on is the direct potable reuse study. As Dave mentioned, we've brought on Corollo engineers to help with the support of that study, and that actually kicked off last month. We also kicked off earlier this year the runoff diversion study. We brought on Geosyntec to help support the planning efforts associated with that and preliminary design. And I'm going to talk a little bit more in detail about those two studies in the coming slides. We are also in the process of procuring an outreach consultant to help support the robust education and outreach program that we have planned for this project. And we hope to bring that consultant on board later this summer. To support with the education planning efforts, we anticipate embarking on a visioning concept this year to really understand, you know, what is the vision for this education center and what is the potential for that facility. And we are looking at potentially partnering with the County of Orange to reuse an existing concession building that they have within the Laguna Niguel Park that is currently not being utilized, that they're actually in the process of trying to repurpose. And then lastly, we are looking later this fall to issue an RFP for an environmental consultant to bring them on to help support a CEQA environmental review of the entire program. And I do want to mention, Dave mentioned earlier that we did receive grant funding for this project, and we're very excited that we received nearly $2 million in grant funding from two different federal agencies. And I want to mention that from one of those federal agencies, our project was actually ranked the number one project within the state of California. So we're very excited to be able to have those funds to be able to support these planning efforts as we move forward. So a little bit about the direct potable reuse planning study. So what we're looking at is a 3 million gallon facility located in the blue area shown on this map that's directly adjacent to the regional treatment plant, which is shown in the gray area. And 3 MGD represents roughly 15% of our total potable water supply. So it's pretty significant for bringing local water reliability for our service area. So the planning study will ultimately identify the layout of the site. And I want to mention that the direct potable reuse facility will only utilize source flow from the regional treatment plant. And the regional treatment plant only receives wastewater from the Moulton-Niguel service area. So that's very important from a source control perspective. I'm going to be talking about the runoff diversion in the future slide, but I do want to mention that they are separate sources. So only wastewater would feed the regional treatment plant, and the runoff would go to the recycled water system, and those remain separate sources of water. We have met with the State Water Resources Control Board, DDW staff, to have early engagement on this project and get their input. And our goal overall is to maintain early and consistent regulatory engagement throughout the project. We also plan to have a very robust education and outreach program, not only for the entirety of the OASIS program, but particularly for this project component, as it will be bringing a new source of local water supply for our customers. We are also looking to implement a direct potable reuse pilot plant. The pilot plant will follow the prescribed regulatory treatment train shown on this slide. We're evaluating the exact location where this pilot plant might be located. One of the locations that we're considering is at our headquarters in Laguna Niguel, which is actually not far from the regional treatment plant. And so this pilot plant will not only help to inform the design of the full-scale facility, but it'll also help to be something that we can use for education and outreach with all of the stakeholders and the regulators as well. So moving into the runoff diversion planning study. So the concept for this, as Dave mentioned earlier, is to divert flows from the Aliso Creek and send that through our existing infrastructure within the park, where we can then have that flow into the Laguna Niguel Lake for use in the recycled water system. And again, just want to repeat that the runoff flows from Aliso Creek would remain separate. It would not go into the sewer system, and it would not enter the regional treatment plant. It would be used solely to support the recycled water system. A little bit about the Aliso Creek watershed. So it drains through 7 cities in South Orange County. It roughly has a 36 square mile drainage area. The creek itself runs 19 miles and discharges into the Pacific Ocean at Aliso Beach, which is located in the city of Laguna Beach. And then a little bit about Laguna Niguel Lake. So as Dave mentioned, the Laguna Niguel Lake is owned and operated by the Parks Department. The lake is available for year-round onshore fishing, and they actually stock that lake with fish couple times a year. So no boating, no swimming, no contact recreation is currently allowed for that lake. The lake itself is flow through. So the lake receives flow from Sulphur Creek. Sulphur Creek gets flow from the surrounding communities. That then flows through the lake. The lake outlets through the park. And then after it exits the park, it confluences with Aliso Creek. And then that discharges to the ocean.
Sorry, quick question. Speaking of discharge to the ocean, I'm sure if you were here during the public comment for non-agendized items, you may have heard reference to breaching of berms at Aliso Beach. I'm just curious whether I understood that this is in the planning process and you guys are here on an informational item only, but have you thought about the downstream impacts that far down to the beach?
Absolutely. And I will get into that a little bit more when I'm talking about the impacts, but we actually work very closely within the Aliso Creek watershed, which includes, all of the agencies within the Aliso Creek. So we have had discussions with the city of Laguna Beach. We've had discussions with some of the environmental groups that are concerned with the breaching of the berm. So we're well aware of that issue. And we will be looking at the downstream impacts overall, especially as, you know, the estuary project is also downstream, and that's a big project for, you know, the city of Laguna Beach. So we think overall, you know, with a reduction of flows, that'll actually potentially help that issue with the breaching of the berm. It's not going to eliminate the flows. But, you know, as we continue to have discussions within the watershed, and I'll talk a little bit about that as well, we're building a robust education program as we work through this, because there's a lot of competing things going on within the watershed. There's a lot of important, you know, projects going on, a lot of different, you know, environmental concerns. And we want to make sure that we're well aware of all of that and have a good understanding of what the impact to this project is downstream, not only for other water users, but for the estuary as well as the beach and the beach water quality. So the planning study, so this project is building on the foundational work that's been done within the Aliso Creek for quite some time. I want to credit the County of Orange Stormwater Program. As you mentioned earlier, they have, you know, a very robust program that is leaders in this, and they have been collecting data on water quality, on water flows for quite some time. So we're going to be able to utilize that historical data, as well as the data that is available from the Parks Department through their management of the lake. Also, we'll be building on the flow ecology study that the county led. The flow ecology study really started to build the foundation for what is the environmental flows needed within the watershed. If we want to use water responsibly within the watershed, how much water is needed for the creek? And that flow ecology really started to help provide some of that information that we'll need to get to that next answer. And then lastly, the County of Orange and Molten-Niguel, we embarked on a joint effort to implement the Smart Watershed Network. It was an innovative project that implemented flow meters and conductivity sensors throughout the watershed. So it really helps to provide a daily data set so we can understand what is the water balance throughout the watershed. And so we're not starting from ground zero as we move forward with this planning study. We have a lot of robust information that we're building off of. For the planning study, we're looking to determine, is runoff diversion feasible and beneficial to the watershed? How much water is there available for diversion, and what is the timing of that water availability? Does it help meet the needs that we're looking for to help support the recycled water system? So one of the things that we're going to be looking at is the hydrology and the hydraulics of the creek, and specifically looking at downstream impacts. We also need to evaluate the lake's potential to store water. How does that balance with the needs of the recycled water system? And then in looking at the needs for water storage, we also need to understand the impacts on the lake to water quality, and then the recreational impacts from the lake as well. The recreation of the lake is an important community benefit. So how does building infrastructure within the park have an impact to that recreation? And so, as Dave mentioned, we're looking at implementing a natural treatment system. Because water flows from Sulphur Creek and basically collects water from residential areas, it's very similar to the water quality from the Aliso Creek that also drains largely residential areas. So there's not a huge difference in terms of the water quality from Sulphur Creek and the water quality from Aliso Creek, but we do believe that the natural treatment system has the ability to provide some level of improvement to water quality, but also provides an educational benefit and a community recreational benefit as well. And then, as I mentioned, you know, looking at the impacts to the park, you know, we'll be utilizing this infrastructure. How can we make improvements to the park? As what opportunities are there? You know, one of the big community draws there is the walking trail around the lake. It's a beautiful lake, and it's an important recreational resource. And as we're looking at potentially adding flows to the lake, how does that impact the walking trails around the lake? And is there an opportunity for us to make improvements and really make this a community benefit project in addition to watershed resiliency and local water reliability? How can we help, you know, bring resources to the community as well? And so we're not only approaching this project as a watershed resiliency project, but, you know, potentially helping the ecosystem of the creek. And so we anticipate a 2-year planning study process followed by preliminary design if it's determined that a diversion is feasible. And then lastly, in terms of next steps, we're interested in learning about how best to engage with this team. We did meet recently with the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board staff and want to continue to have that engagement as we move throughout the planning process. We want to make sure that we're collecting the information and the analysis that's going to be needed to help support the regulatory permits that are going to be needed. And so we're looking for your guidance and leadership ultimately on what is the best permitting path forward for this project. We have developed a stakeholder outreach education plan specifically for this watershed, this runoff diversion study, because we want to make sure that we're engaging the downstream users. We want to make sure that we're engaging the environmental organizations, the regulatory agencies, not just yourself, but all of the regulatory agencies. So that way, we have this information as we're forming the basis of our project, and we can use that to, you know, basically build the best project that we can possibly build that will ultimately be permittable. So we really want this to be a transparent process where we engage stakeholders throughout the entirety of the process. That concludes our presentation, but I just want to, you know, echo our thanks for, you know, taking the time to hear about this important project. We're very excited about it and very excited to have the opportunity to share this important project with you. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Anybody from, Betty, did you? Anybody from the public here or online? Hearing none, I want to thank you, and we look forward to visiting this and seeing it with our own eyes here this afternoon. So that'll be, go ahead, Betty.
So what's the harvest that you're going to get from the creek, or what do you think your yield will be from the creek for recycled water for irrigation purposes? And also, what's the impact of the sulfur springs on the water quality of the creek water?
So in terms of yield, I am cautious to give the exact amount of water because that's ultimately the fundamental question that the planning study is looking to answer. You know, we know, as Dave mentioned, we know that there are unnatural flows within the creek. There's more water within the creek than there should be. We're starting, you know, we have some of this data to help us understand, you know, what those flows look like, where is that water flowing and at what time is it flowing. We also, you know, are building off of, as I mentioned, the flow ecology, you know, so that we can understand, all right, so we know there's this much water. And from an environmental perspective, we know that these types of species, you know, focal species, fish species, sensitive habitats need this amount of water. So what is that nexus? And that's really what this study is going to help us understand. So I'm hesitant to throw out a number because that could really change based on, you know, the data that we evaluate. But that's fundamentally the question that this study will answer. And we hope to have an answer to that within the next year. In terms of water quality, you know, we do know that there is high TDS within Sulphur Creek, within the Aliso Creek, and water quality varies, you know, throughout the year based on how much flow there is. I will say that the focus of our diversions is for dry weather, and that is because during dry weather, that is when the recycled water needs are highest in the summer and when we're, you know, the customers are utilizing a lot of that recycled water. And so, you know, our main focus is on the dry weather flows, and that's going to have, I think, a little bit more of a higher TDS than we're going to see in winter when we have, you know, some of those rain waters to help kind of flush some of that out. But we are, you know, we've already started to implement a robust a water quality monitoring plan. We've been monitoring on a monthly basis for over a year now, so we can start to have an understanding of that, how the natural treatment system might affect the water quality, and if we need to do additional treatment system or additional treatment in order to meet the recycled water permit requirements. So more information to come on all of that.
Betty, can you turn on your mic,
in the
please?
Summertime, I believed historically they thought it was from over-irrigation, but you've put into plan a number of conservation plans, so there still is additional flow
that is not attributed to over irrigating?
So you're correct. So largely what we have is not necessarily, like some of it is from over irrigation. And I do want to mention that, you know, as a water district and working, you know, in conjunction with the County of Orange on their stormwater program, reducing that has been a huge drive for us, especially, you know, going back, you know, 10, 15 years from a water use perspective where, you know, driving down demand was a top priority for Moulton-Niguel so that we could, you know, have customers use water efficiently. And that remains at the forefront of, you know, what we do through our water efficiency programs, through our rebate programs. But there is still, you know, there is still some over-irrigation that occurs, but it's not all over-irrigation. Within our service area, you know, we have some clay soils and some very shallow groundwater basins where even people that water efficiently, that water still seeps into areas and pops back up. So we can be as efficient as possible, but that doesn't necessarily prevent it from coming back up into and making its way down into the creek. So we're really looking at opportunities to try and bring that water balance back into a more natural flow, but trying to understand exactly, you know, what that balance is and how much of that water is natural versus unnatural and how much of that water is needed for the environment is really what we're trying to solve with this study.
And you expect you'll have the answer in 2 years, correct?
I'm sorry, what was that?
You expect to have the answer in 2 years.
So I'm hoping to have that answer within the next year, but the entirety of the planning process done within 2 years. Thank you so much.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you. And with that, we're going to adjourn to closed session, but I need to ask our resident lawyer here to make a statement.
Hello. During the board will be adjourned to closed session and will meet to consider the evaluation of performance of the executive officer, and it's labeled item number 9 on the agenda.
With that, thank you all for attending. We appreciate it, and we'll hopefully see you back here next year or in San Diego in between. Motion to adjourn. We are now adjourned.